From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Marilyn Morning. If you live in Baltimore and you want really fast internet access at home, you're out of luck. A group in the city wants to change that. We talk with them about their goal to bring faster, cheaper internet to the city. Then Jonathan Rapping trains public defenders in Maryland how to handle the stresses of an underpaid, overworked profession. He just won a MacArthur Genius Grant for his work. We talk with him about what it takes to be a public defender. Plus, after performing outdoors for years, Chesapeake Shakespeare Company has a new stage, a new building, and a roof. The company's artistic director and managing director lead Tom Hall on a tour of their new theater in downtown Baltimore. First, today's news.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock. That's on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WYPR.org. Now, on with the podcast.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Can you remember the last time you went a day without using the internet at some point? It's changed how we live and work. What hasn't changed of late is the speed of our internet, at least in Baltimore. A group of residents has started the Baltimore Broadband Campaign to try to change that. Phil Spivak is an organizer with the campaign, and he joins us now to talk about it. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So when you talk about the next revolution in high-speed internet, it's really about access to fiber optic cable. Fiber optic networks. I mean, if you look at a map where you can find fiber in the Baltimore region, you see that there is access all around Baltimore, but very little inside of it. Why?
Well, I think that it's a few things. I think that it is partially that we have had not had an articulation of a vision and a plan that's been clear. We've had some turnover in the city's Office of Technology over the years, and that's complicated things. I think there's an idea now in the city of what that plan should be, but that's complicated things in 3, 4, 5 years ago. I think the other thing is that we believe that what will really motivate change is the economics. And I think that the potential to fiber providers in Baltimore hasn't been entirely clear. And that's why one of the reasons we started our campaign. We think that where fiber providers go in, their businesses, they want to know that they're going to make money on their investment. And we think that that hasn't been demonstrated sufficiently in the city for them to be attracted. So the philosophy of our campaign, we are using crowdfunding. We're asking people to back the campaign, and we map them. And we show where there's sufficient demand that we believe will attract fiber providers.
And well, so how much are you asking people actually to put up some money to say, I'm serious about fast internet. I would actually pay money for fast internet.
Yeah, we're asking for two things. We're asking them to put in a small amount of money, $10, $100, and we're asking them to put their name and their address in. It's a token contribution. We're actually using the money for this all-volunteer effort to cover some of our small marketing costs. The main thing we're doing is we're asking people to say they're dissatisfied with what they have now. And the campaign has really resonated because people are frustrated by the status quo. They're frustrated by the fact that they really have no choice. So when you started, you asked me about, you know, where are we now? If you look at broadband, which is connecting to the internet above a certain speed, we have one choice. We have Comcast. And what we found when we started the campaign is people are frustrated by not having a choice of another provider. We also found that people are frustrated by price. We did some analysis, and we found that if you compare our prices, say, to Anne Arundel County.
The price in the city.
Price in the city.
The Comcast.
That's right. And we found, prices go up and down. It's hard to compare this package, that package. But we've found that the difference in the cost of packages between what you'd pay in Baltimore and Anne Arundel County over a two-year period may be as much as $1,000. And we also found that the options that you have, I do cardiac imaging and I download
big, you're a doctor in
I'm
real
a
life.
Doctor, that's right. And I download big imaging files. We don't have the same high-speed options that you have in the counties that have fiber, those counties you referred to.
Well, let me try to clarify a few things. When I ask why is there this map that shows very little, shows basically no high speed access in the city.
The fiber.
I ask why, and you answered in terms of city policy and turnover in the city, etc.
And economics.
Yes, but you first went to the city. We reached out to the mayor's office to talk to somebody there about what efforts they're making to bring broadband to the city, and they said they couldn't give us anyone to talk to about the issue on air now. They have hired consultants to look at how the city could support growth of high-speed fiber optic network. What do you see as the city's role in making this happen?
Well, I want to say first, I think that the current administration has expressed new interest in this issue. And this is different than 3, 4, 5 years ago that I'm aware of. And that's a good thing. You have the mayor pointing out that 20% to 40% of the city doesn't even connect to the internet in this whole issue of economic injustice, digital injustice. That's a really important issue. And then you also have the mayor who, on the one hand, says we want to attract 10,000 new families to Baltimore. She expresses an understanding that you aren't going to attract high-tech businesses to Baltimore if you have a infrastructure that can't support it. So I think that there is the beginning of the understanding and the development of leadership that I'm more optimistic about. I think that what the city has to do is that they have to make it, they have to have a clear set of rules so that if a fiber provider wanted to come in and put in fiber, that they would know what that would be. For example, Baltimore has a lot of conduit. Conduit is where fiber would pass through underneath the streets. They're very unusual. They own 3.9 million feet of this conduit. But we don't yet have a complete map of where that conduit is and an understanding of the condition of the conduit. So we need that map. We also need city policies that facilitate fiber deployment. Roland Avenue, where I live, is being dug up, and we have fiber that goes up to the fire station, but we have a school about a quarter of a mile up from there, and we're not taking advantage of the street being dug up to put the fiber in. And when you put fiber in, it's the cost of doing it is reduced about 70% if you can take advantage of projects that are already going. So you need, with every utility project, you need a city policy that looks to say, we want to lay the fiber. I think the most important thing is you need a vision, a plan, and what you're trying to achieve. And that's what our campaign has tried to put forward. We think the vision should be that there needs to be fiber deployed throughout the city, to every school, to every library, to businesses, and to homes. We believe it's not a one-size-fits-all strategy. It needs to prioritize in a couple ways. One is we need to hook up the schools and the libraries and the anchored institutions, which are really key. And the other is that we need to be driven by where market demand is. We think there are parts of the city that will want fiber to their home, but we believe that it needs to be an inclusive campaign. So where you have parts of the city where that demand may not be so strong, you might have a hybrid technology. So I think the city has not stepped forward with a vision like we think that our campaign has. I think those are the three main things that the city needs to do.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Phil Spivak. He's an organizer with the Baltimore Broadband Campaign. They want to bring faster, cheaper internet access to Baltimore. The city is not in great financial shape. Of all the problems it has to deal with, why should it be focusing on this one?
Yeah. Well, I think that's an important question. I think this is an issue of infrastructure. And this is a challenge we face. I think when the water mains are breaking and water is gushing up in the air and the sewage is backing up in people's homes, you know, that certainly begs attention. I think why the city should be interested in this are a few things. First of all, this is essential for the economic growth of the city. As much as having water lines and sewer lines that work, you need this infrastructure. The other thing is that there actually are cost savings for the city by deploying a fiber technology. If you look at a county like Howard County, for example, Howard County put fiber in, and now the schools are no longer paying what I would say exorbitant prices to some of the vendors for school data services. So they've estimated, for example, they're saving $1.8 million over the next 5 years. So the city, the schools, they spend a lot on data and telecommunications. if you have a fiber network that the city perhaps owns or has an investment interest, they can use that for their own data and telecommunication needs. So it's possible that they could have cost savings by doing it. And then the last thing is I referred to earlier is they have a lot of conduit. It's valuable. So even if the city does not want to be the one to put in the fiber, by leasing it, there's revenues that cities can earn by leasing that to fiber providers to use for them to then become the ISPs, the internet service providers.
And I'm still groping to get a picture of what you're envisioning. Are you envisioning that the city would operate a fiber network? Or do you envision that, I mean, for example, Comcast now has, through 2016, it has the exclusive cable rights. Is that going to go away in your vision of what happens in the future? Is this going to be a business deal? Yeah. Or something that the city does?
Well, let's first clarify one of the myths. So Comcast does not have an exclusive cable deal. Comcast has a non-exclusive franchise for television. That means that...
I stand corrected.
Well, it's something that I, you know, when you asked what's held this up, I think that some of these myths have clouded the thinking of people. So there's no legal barrier to a fiber provider coming in. Now, to the method of ownership that you alluded to, I don't think we know the answer. And the reason we don't know the answer is we need more information from the city to know what their interests are. There are different models, and there are different models that are successful. So you do have a city like Chattanooga in Tennessee that does own a fiber network. They're the ISP.
The
internet service provider. And it's very popular. In fact, now you have cities surrounding Chattanooga that would like to be connected to it. You have some cities where there are public-private partnerships, where a city like Baltimore says, you know, we can't do it. We're having trouble reading the water meters. This is not something we want to take on, but we still think it's important. In that situation, you could then have the city lease conduit to a private provider who would come in.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Phil Spivak. He's an organizer with the Baltimore Broadband Campaign. We also reached out to Verizon, which offers Fios, their high-speed fiber network, to areas outside Baltimore City. A spokesperson says, as in the past, they have no plans to expand Fios into Baltimore. We've got more information about the Baltimore Broadband Campaign on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass. Just ahead, a MacArthur genius on his work with the Public Defender's Office in Maryland. Stay with us on 88.1.
Producer Jamila Kay. Go to our website to learn more about a segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Thanks, Nathan. This is Maryland Morning on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Only about one in four people charged with a felony in the U.S. can afford a lawyer. Most of the rest depend on public defenders, often so overworked it's hard to provide a quality defense. Lawyer Jonathan Rapping calls that a civil rights crisis. 7 years ago, Rapping started a training and mentoring program for public defenders in the South. This spring, he brought the same techniques and training to public defenders throughout Maryland. And this week, he got a vote of confidence from the MacArthur Foundation, which gave him one of their 21 genius grants. And Jonathan Rapping joins us on the line from WABE in Atlanta. Welcome to Maryland Morning.
Thanks so much, Sheila. It's great to be with you.
It's great to talk to you. Congratulations. What kind of surprise was it when you got the call on Tuesday?
It was somewhat surreal, somewhat overwhelming. I think I still am waiting for someone to call me up and say, just kidding. But it's been great. It's been great.
You were a public defender in Washington, D.C. before you began training public defenders. Why did you make that switch?
Well, I started my career in Washington, D.C., spent my first 10 years as a public defender there. And I was fortunate because that really is one of the few offices in the country that has manageable caseloads and has the resources that allow lawyers to give poor people the kind of representation the Constitution demands. But in 2004, there was an effort to build a new statewide public defender system in Georgia, and I was asked to come down and be the training director. And it seemed like a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to be in on the ground floor of a real reform effort. So I agreed to do that. And 2 years later, after Katrina hit New Orleans, I was invited to come to New Orleans and help rebuild the public defender office there. I did some work in Mississippi and Alabama, and it was really my first introduction to the fact that in most of this country, our criminal justice systems have come to accept an embarrassingly low standard of justice for poor people. So I made the switch because I thought it would be exciting, but it turned out being an eye-opening experience that changed the course of my career.
And the course of that career included 7 years ago starting a nonprofit that's now called Gideon's Promise, a name that refers to that constitutional right that you just talked about, the Supreme Court decision in 1963 in Gideon v. Wainwright that held that an indigent defendant has a constitutional right to representation, and that created the public defender system. You're partnering this year with the Maryland Office of Public Defender, which has 570 lawyers. Tell us about the work you're doing here.
Well, I think to understand the import of the work that that Gideon's Promise is doing with Maryland, you do have to understand that 51 years ago the Supreme Court said that justice really depends on people having a lawyer, that a lawyer is necessary to ensure that all of us are able to realize our most fundamental rights when we're charged with a crime. And if we believe in equal justice, poor people must have access to the same kinds of lawyers that you and I would pay for, lawyers with the training, the resources, the heart, the commitment. So that's what Gideon's Promise is meant to address, helping create a community of lawyers who can live up to that standard. The Maryland is like public defender systems across the country. Their lawyers have more cases than they can handle, consistent with their ethical obligations in the Constitution. They don't have enough resources. And the head of that system, Paul DeWolf, who spent some time working with our leadership community in Gideon's Promise, was really excited about the work we are doing to try to help lawyers stay inspired and not get burned out and jaded in systems that really want them to process human beings. So Paul DeWolf invited Gideon's Promise to partner with him, and we are now working with the lawyers across Maryland, not only to teach them the skills they need to be effective advocates, but also to be change agents, to go into systems that have oftentimes lost sight of justice and to resist pressures to become resigned to the status quo, to push back against the systems, to push the systems to live up to our most noble ideals.
On 88.1, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Jonathan Rapping. He won a MacArthur Genius Grant this week for his work training and mentoring public defenders. Since May, he's been working with public defenders in Maryland. HBO featured your work in the documentary called Gideon's Army, which followed several young public defenders in the South. And in one scene, you're leading a discussion of the challenges these young public defenders are facing. And one of them says this.
I closed over 500 felonies last year, and I have 165 pending cases right now. They're all felonies, and I cannot be an effective attorney at those numbers.
With public defenders under that kind of workload, how much can the kind of motivational work you do really help? I mean, why not work on drumming up bigger budgets to hire more public defenders?
Well, so I listened to that clip, and I have to say it breaks my heart because that's one of over 300 young public defenders we've trained who faces those sorts of odds. But I think what we recognize is we can't train anyone to handle 500 cases well. But what we can do is we can fight against systemic pressures that cause lawyers to accept that what they're doing for 500 clients is okay, to accept a low standard. So what we do is we work with those lawyers to forgive themselves for not being able to handle 500 cases well, but to really work on handling as many of those cases well as they can, work on keeping them inspired and supporting them, not just to be good lawyers today, but to develop them into tomorrow's leaders. And when we develop them into tomorrow's leaders, and we have a community of leaders who really appreciate what poor people deserve, then we'll have a landscape of advocates who can push for exactly what you're talking about, Sheila, who can push systems to increase the budgets, to decriminalize certain behavior, to make sure that no one is brought into the system if we don't have the resources to give them the justice the Constitution demands. But we have to groom those leaders because, quite frankly, our criminal justice system is populated with people, judges, prosecutors, defenders, who are well-intentioned, but their values and their assumptions have been shaped by a system that has come to accept injustice. So before we can start to advocate for the reforms that you're talking about, we have to build a community of advocates who truly embrace those values that the Supreme Court talked about in the Gideon decision 51 years ago.
In the film, we see one of the public defenders struggling with the caseload and thinking about leaving the work. You've been working with lots of public defenders here in Maryland. How many of them do you think will still be public defenders in 5 years?
Well, I think public defense across the country is an occupation that has a high turnover rate because if you care, it is really emotionally taxing. My bigger fear than people leaving is that people who become burned out and jaded will stay. Because everyone deserves a passionate lawyer. And when public defenders get burnt out, which is natural in this business, they can do a disservice to their clients. So I focus less on retention and more on making sure that those who choose to stay, stay inspired, stay true to a value set that their clients deserve, and have the skills, the values, and the tools they need to do what the Constitution demands. But I think you put your finger on an important problem, and that is that this is a job that is hard to last in.
We're down to like 10 seconds. The money aspect of the MacArthur Genius Grant is $625,000 over 5 years. What are you going to do with it?
That's a hard question. I haven't figured that out yet, but I'm sure that will help us keep the doors open when times get a little bit tough. So,
we'll keep in touch with you about it. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Jonathan Rapping, he's president and founder of Gideon's Promise, a nonprofit based in Atlanta that trains and supports the work of public defenders. He's been partnering with the Maryland Office of Public Defender since May, and he's on leave as an associate professor at the John Marshall Law School in Atlanta. More information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. And just ahead, a new home for Shakespeare. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Jamila Kay. Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall, and I'm here this morning at the new home of the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company. It's a beautiful theater that has been designed to replicate, to some extent, the Globe Theater, where the Bard himself held forth in Elizabethan England. Tonight, the company gives its first performance in this new home on Calvert Street in what used to be the Mercantile Trust and Deposit Company building. It's at the corner of Calvert and Redwood in downtown Baltimore. Tonight's audience will comprise company members and local theater professionals. Tomorrow night, Chesapeake Shakespeare opens its doors to the public with a performance and gala celebrating this milestone for the 12-year-old company. On Sunday, the company will have a family festival with tours of the theater and a chance to meet the actors in their inaugural production of A Midsummer Night's Dream. I'm joined today by Ian Gallagher, the company's founding artistic director, and Leslie Malin, the managing director, who also appears as an actor in some productions. Welcome to you both, and congratulations. So, Ian, what is this theater from the perspective of a director, perspective of an actor? We're sitting here right on the stage here in this beautiful, beautiful new space. What's it going to mean for the work of the people in the productions.
Well, it's exciting. I mean, it's not only exciting to build a new theater, but it's exciting to build one that's custom-made for the aesthetic of our company. And one of the things that's most important to us is that we see theater as a shared experience. It's not just artists on one side of the room and audience on the other side of the room, but it's something that we're in the same room together. And you cannot hide from, audiences can't hide from each other even in this room. It is a building built to share theater with artists and audience members.
And so, Leslie, your perspective as a managing director is one hat you wear. You've also, of course, been on stage, but put yourself in the hat of a person sitting in the audience. What is the experience for the audience going to be, and how will it differ perhaps from other theaters that folks are used to, or certainly from your former digs at various places where you performed?
Well, we hope it'll be a really fun experience for people. People love informality when they're outside, and we're hoping to bring that kind of relaxed atmosphere indoors as well, so that people feel free to get up and move around during the production. One of the exciting things is that the lights are on during the performance. The audience is lit as well through much of it, so you can watch the folks on the other side of the room enjoying the show at the same time as you are. So it's a very communal, warm, intimate experience.
And so, Ian, as a director, I mean, you're directing this first show in the inaugural season here in the new theater. When you've got the audience lit, when the audience really is, you know, visible to the actors, I mean, sometimes when you're on a stage, the lights are such that you can't see anybody. You know there's somebody out there. You hear the applause at the end of the show, but you're not seeing them. How does that affect the people's approach to the roles and people's approach to the work?
Well, you know, these plays are written in such a way that that the characters are often aware of the fact that they're in a play. They talk about it, certainly in prologues in the plays, they talk about them being in a play. So that, and obviously too, Shakespeare has a lot of direct address. It's a term we use when actors or characters address the audience directly. So these plays are built for that kind of relationship. And it actually makes it, I think, the production stronger.
And so, Leslie, you've obviously taken a lot of care, done a lot of research, tried to figure out what it is you wanted in this theater. We mentioned the Globe Theater in London as a kind of an inspiration. What sorts of research did you do? What sorts of thinking and what kinds of calculations were you making as you decided the elements that you wanted to include here in the new building?
Well, honestly, one of the best things for Ian and me is that we belong to the Shakespeare Theatre Association, which is an international association of professional Shakespeare theaters. And so we have, every year we go to a different Shakespeare company and go to a different theater. So we've been to the Globe with a lot of other Shakespeare professionals, and we've been to Shakespeare and Company, we've been to Colorado, we've been to the American Shakespeare Center. So going to all of these different theaters, we've managed to pick and choose a little bit about we want that, we're not going to do that, we've got to have that. As a matter of fact, our seats came from sitting in Shakespeare and Company's beautiful theater in Massachusetts, and these are bench seats, they're cushioned, they're ergonomically designed, and as soon as Ian and I sat down in them, and this was 6 years ago, I said, when we have our own theater, I want these seats. And yes, we have these seats.
And so, Ian, you obviously, in addition to really comfy seats, and I can confirm what Leslie is contending here, because I'm sitting in one right now, and it really is comfy. But you also have a number of other you have access to a number of other rooms and spaces that you haven't had access to when you've been doing your performances, for example, in the summer where you work at the Patuxent Female Institute, or you're outside. Obviously, you've got some things here that you never had access to outside.
Yeah, for instance, indoor plumbing, which is good. Outdoors, we were using portalettes. You know, we didn't have dressing rooms. The actors dressed in either tents, or we had sort of these containers, you know, metal containers they would dress in. Of course, we decorate them with Christmas lights to make it a little jollier, but nothing compares with actual indoor dressing rooms and showers. Can you imagine that? Yeah. It all feels like quite a luxury to us.
I know as a performer, you know, sometimes you play rooms that are pretty sort of down in the dumps
and seedy and kind of crazy. And other times you play auditoriums and rooms that are, you know, fully modernized and really a pleasure to be in. And there's a different vibe for all of the performers. I know in the music and, you know, the chorus, the orchestra feels differently when we're playing the Kennedy Center than we do when we're playing an abandoned high school and, you know, in a rural area. The audiences are great in both places, but it does change the molecular structure of the room, doesn't it, to be in a new surrounding.
Yeah, it sure does. And one of the things I guess I was surprised to see, or it was unexpected anyways, you know, generally our actors and artists come to rehearsals ready to work and eager to be a part of the collaborative. But in, you know, these kind of difficult spaces, they kind of show up and ready to work and sort of, I don't know, almost brace themselves for the work. Here, what I found is that the artists are coming in much earlier, like sometimes as much as an hour before rehearsal. And the attitude about them coming into the space is completely different. It makes them feel like what they can contribute is, I don't know, sort of treasured or valued more. And that was extraordinary to me. And I'm really happy to be around that vibe, as you put it.
Ian Gallagher is the founding artistic director of the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company. He's here with me this morning along with Leslie Malin, the managing director of the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company. They'll open their doors to the public tomorrow night for their first gala performance of A Midsummer Night's Dream. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall here at the Chesapeake Shakespeare Theater at the corner of Redwood and Calvert in downtown Baltimore. So, Leslie, the Baltimore Shakespeare Theater was an established group, although certainly had its troubles during its history, and it finally was not able to sustain itself. You saw that as an opportunity, I guess, to move your operation from Ellicott City, where you had been based, to here in downtown Baltimore.
We did. When the Baltimore Shakespeare Festival was here, we thought, well, that would be silly to have two Shakespeare companies in the same city, and Howard County had a need for more arts, and they really embraced us over the years. But as we wanted to grow, and we kept looking for suitable indoor opportunities, we couldn't find them in Howard County. The property values are just too much. And so when the Baltimore Shakespeare Festival closed its doors, you know, Vinnie Lancisi, for instance, said, hey, you guys ought to look in Baltimore. And a number of other people said, and we said to ourselves, you know what, let's go take a look. And we were astonished at the opportunities here. And when we walked into this space, we really fell in love with it. We knew it was the right place as soon as we walked in. And, you know, we called our board chair and said, you got to come over. And he said, well, I guess we better get it.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, some folks see this as an opportunity. Obviously, you do, and you're very excited, and you've gotten a lot of support. You've been able to, you know, fund most of the costs of building this building. But there are other folks who will say, hey, look, you know, the reason the Baltimore Shakespeare Theater didn't make it is because a Shakespeare theater didn't make it. What do you think is going to be different about Chesapeake Shakespeare that will allow it to sustain itself in a way that the other Shakespeare theater wasn't able to do?
Partially luck. But that's not the real answer. The real answer, I think, is, you know, we've been growing every year for the past 12 years, and our growth has been very smart, and we've concentrated on doing it in a healthy way, so that we come into this, I think, with a lot of experience. For instance, our administrative team has been together for more than a decade. Some of our arts collaborators have been together for more than a decade. I think we come into it with a lot of experience and a lot of knowledge about not just producing Shakespeare, but also about the business side of running an organization. And I think that's going to work to our advantage. But of course, you have to make a case to people. You know, you have to say, give them a reason to come see the work. And then once they come, you have to deliver on what you've promised. So we intend to do that as well.
Certainly, the Everyman Theater, the Single Carrot Theater, both of whom have built new buildings in these last couple of years. This is the third new theater in town in as many years. Everyman 2 years ago, the Single Carrot last year, and now Chesapeake Shakespeare here this year. That's a lot of theater. Do you worry that the market is getting saturated, Leslie Malin?
I do not worry at all about the market being saturated. I think that people need live theater more than ever. They need the live arts. People are spending so much time on their little devices that they need an opportunity to be in a room together with other people experiencing something important and bigger than just what's on their cell phone. So I think that there's huge opportunities for us. And certainly, you know, as a classics theater, we're not doing anything close to what Single Carrot is doing. We're not doing what Everyman is doing. I think there's plenty of space for us, and I think that the audience in Baltimore can only grow, much as it has in Washington, D.C., where that theater community has just exploded in recent years to the point where I believe it's the second largest theater community in the country now.
So, Ian, we can hear some sirens outside. So you've made it a point to not suggest that this is going to be some soundproof room that's disconnected to the community. In fact, Shakespeare, of course, one of the great historical figures of all time, and you have really embraced the notion of the history of this building to the point where you've even won an award for preserving so many of the original architectural details in this building, which was originally a bank building.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's important to us that we sort of marry the three historical eras, which is, of course, the Elizabethan period. And we've designed the stage and the theater in such a way that it resembles that geography, as it were. And also the period then when this building was built, which is the Victorian period, so 1880s here in downtown Baltimore. And it is a distinctly Baltimore building as well.
Well, Ian, congratulations. This is a gorgeous, gorgeous place, and I can't wait to be with you tomorrow night and to see the production of Midsummer Night's Dream. Congratulations, and thanks for your time.
Thanks so much, Tom. Appreciate it.
And Leslie, break a leg.
Thanks. We're looking forward to our big night.
Ian Gallagher is the artistic director, Leslie Malin, the managing director of the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company. Their inaugural season in their new home starts tomorrow night with a gala performance of Shakespeare's great comedy, A Midsummer Night's Dream. By the way, I misspoke earlier. I said the Patuxent Female Institute. It's the Patapsco Female Institute in Howard County. But anyway, they will continue doing performances there in the summers. But during the season, they're here in this beautiful new theater. And on Sunday, the company will host a family festival, which includes a performance and a chance to tour the theater. We've got a link to more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Reporting from downtown Baltimore, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Maryland Morning is an original production of Your Public Radio, WYPR in Baltimore. You can learn more about what you've heard on our show or catch something you've missed on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. The show is produced by Matt Purdy and Jamila Kay. Nathan Sterner directs and engineers. Tom Hall is our culture editor. We have production help from Payam Agagasam and Elizabeth Sherwood. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. See you next time.